Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Single mother Lo Siu Hong has succeeded in her legal bid to quash the unlawful detention of her three children who had been unilaterally converted to Islam. Lo, who is a Hindu Chinese, was awarded sole custody of the three children, a pair of 14-year-old twins and a 10-year-old, this after her divorce from Nageswaran Munyandi. While she was in a domestic abuse shelter, Nageswaran converted to Islam and also unilaterally converted the children without her knowledge. He was arrested for drug-related offences and is now in jail in Kelantan. The children are now under the care of Perlis Welfare Department, but according to the court decision, will likely be reunited with their mother. Why do unilateral conversions continue to happen in Malaysia? Let's ask our first guest today, constitutional lawyer Nizam Bashir. Nizam, let's begin with the Perlis Religious Department and their role, because they claimed that the state laws in Perlis allow for unilateral conversions, although we know that the federal court had previously ruled both parents must consent to such conversions in line with the federal constitution. How should we understand what is at the heart of this contention?
I think the thinking seems to be that the Perlis religious departments and the respective states have an absolute say on Islamic matters. And I think that thinking has most likely caused them to say that unilateral conversions are permissible according to Perlis administration of Islamic law. And as you rightly noted, that appears to fly against the core issue decided upon in the federal court judgment in Indira Gandhi. Of course, by the same token, there may also be some grey areas where that judgment is concerned. Two things come to mind. So, for example, in Indira Gandhi, the facts was the children never appeared before the Registrar of Mualafs. So it pays to ask whether that case applies in cases where the children have appeared before the Registrar. And the second thing that I think may be also somewhat of a grey area is, what if the children themselves want to convert to Islam? Is parental consent, for example, necessary in such a case? In Ri Suzy Teo, the Supreme Court seemed to think so and ruled as such, i.e. striking down the conversion of the child on the basis that parental rights are engaged in conversion of children, given Article 12 of the Federal Constitution. Of course, whatever rights in Article 12 is only applicable in cases where there is a dispute on the religious instruction that the child must receive. So one wonders whether it can supersede what Article 11 says. But either way, I think the Perlis Religious Department may not be really focusing on what those grey areas are, and they're just looking at what they believe to be, you know, their powers where Islamic law is concerned.
Nizam, I mean, it's all quite bewildering and somewhat arcane and Byzantine for most Malaysians, never mind, you know, us who are not of the Muslim faith, in terms of how these institutions operate. But at the heart of it, Nizam, it does seem that we're constantly coming back to stories of parents in dispute using religion or religious institutions to press their advantage against the other parent. Is this what you think is also happening here? And how should the courts, you know, rule, especially in the interest of children in such cases?
Well, I think it's quite unfortunate if parents resort to religion, essentially, to either obtain custody of the child or to secure some sort of, you know, advantage, whatever they think the advantage may be. In their dispute in the family courts. I think certainly if the courts are alerted as to that being a possibility, the court should be quite wary to encourage it. I think, irrespective of whatever the motivations of the parents may be, I think what the courts need to focus upon is always just what is the best interest of the child. Because ultimately, when we're talking about children, that is the paramount principle applicable in determining what the courts need to do, irrespective of whatever specific issue may be before the courts. And I think it may also be sensible to start thinking about what particular rights a child may have, because parents can dispute. But I think it's a bit simpler when we are focusing on what is best for a particular child and taking into account whatever views the child may be able to offer.
Okay, well, can I follow up on that, Nizam? You mentioned that it makes a difference if the child has appeared in front to consent to the conversion. You also talked a little bit about what if the child him or her chooses to convert to Islam. How do we understand that? There's a legal definition of minor as a child. And how does that equate to the religious choices that he or she may want to make?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's a bit more complicated than that, Melissa. I think we have to consider not just what the legal definitions may be. We have, truthfully speaking, we have a far larger issue, and that is the question of conflict of laws, i.e. between Islamic law on some levels and civil law. Now, the Islamic legal position may be somewhat different on a particular issue as compared to what the civil legal position may be. And I'll give you a very simple example. Take child marriage. I mean, we have various provisions in the respective state enactments permitting child marriage to take place, but sexual relations with a person below the age of 16 is criminalized. Yeah. So this is something I think we have to resolve in due course. Now, I've been looking at cases like this since maybe 2006, 2007. So it's been quite a while, but the sense that I get is that we seem to be doing or looking at all these issues in sort of a piecemeal fashion for the moment. And I do wonder whether that's sensible, because some of the questions that we are being asked to sort of answer, either, you know, from the perspective of the courts or even from the perspective of, you know, lawyers who have been looking at this over the years, we don't have, or we seem to be grasping at what should be a framework to look at all these particular issues. And I think all that we have at this point in time seems to be Article 1211A. And I think Article 1211A is actually quite a brilliant piece of provision. But even, I mean, I find that in some instances, you know, I've seen courts, you know, grappling with trying to understand exactly what it seems to offer in cases like this, because it provides a sort of an interesting constitutional framework to resolve some of these issues, i.e. which particular court in the first place is able to answer the issue in question. And today, in fact, beyond the decision that was answered by the High Court, we have also a very important Federal Court judgment coming out on the matter. So today, the civil courts have actually affirmed that civil courts essentially prevail in matters of judicial review. I think that provides some clarity moving forward, at least, you know, if there are particular rights that engage particularly civil rights, we go to the civil courts. And I think that provides a sort of a starting point to you know, drawing up a suitable framework to answer certain difficult questions that may be before the courts.
Right. Nizam, it does seem also that, you know, whatever the law might be, and you're saying it, there are ambiguities. And so some cases get caught in those gray areas, as you put it. But there's also the question of how institutions outside the judicial process, outside the legal framework, also operate. And I'm thinking about the welfare department and why the kids were in Perlis in the first place, the various statements made by muftis, both of Perlis and Penang, and, you know, and the crowds that gathered in front of the courts following the decision, you know, that and any number of demagogues who will remind us of cases as far back as the Maria Hertog case, trying to politicize this issue. I mean, in this kind of mix, I mean, how do we find our way? I mean, is the law so clear, you know, and will people even follow it if they are of the conviction that they have God on their side?
Well, that's a bit of a tough one, Sharat. But let me answer it in this way. I think there's always got to be this dialogue that takes place, yeah. In the sense that sometimes Let's say that there is someone across the other side of the divide or the other side of the fence. They may have their own aspirations, whatever it may be. Yeah, but I think that the meeting point is always the Constitution, because that provides the overarching framework. Irrespective of wherever you're coming from, and even if you may have particular aspirations as to pushing, forward whatever view that you have, with whatever perspectives that you may have as well, you need to engage the Constitution. And as long as you can find a particular landing point within the Constitution, I think that's fine. But ultimately, the courts will have to rule upon whether your perspective, your view as to what the Constitution seems to be saying, whether that's correct or otherwise. And I think sometimes, of course, beyond individuals, we have to look at the institution. Yeah. Sometimes institutions may even have their own biases. Yeah. And I think that there needs to be some sort of retraining that also needs to take place to ensure that it keeps pace, irrespective of whatever the biases may be, it keeps pace with the developments of the law. Ultimately, whatever happens needs to be legal for it to be valid.
Nizam, very quickly, we have about a minute left. Now, I just want to follow up with something you said. You said that often cases like this are dealt with in a piecemeal fashion. What we need is an overarching framework. Where does that begin? Is that just going to the courts at every juncture when there is a case of unilateral conversion?
Not necessarily. I think, people are a bit more comfortable ventilating their anguish, their frustrations in the paper, in the blog, social media. And that sort of, hang on, you are not right. That happens, in a less formal fashion as well. And I've seen cases where people actually back off once the right principle is pointed out to them. So I'm not that cynical yet, and I think we shouldn't be cynical as well. I think there's still hope for a lot of people within the civil service, in the sense that I think people want to do the right thing. It's just a matter of pointing out whether what they're doing is legal or otherwise.
Nizam, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. Constitutional lawyer Nizam Bashir there. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned. Hi, thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. If you've just joined us on the show, tonight we're discussing the unilateral conversion of three children and if their best interest has been prioritized in the way the case had unfolded. Joining us now is Professor Datuk Dr. Noor Azia Awal. She's a commissioner with Suhakam, the Human Rights Commission of Malaysia, and she specifically looks at children's rights. Datuk Azia, the Mufti of Perlis, he had initially claimed that the children did not want to go back to their mother and therefore ought to remain under the care of JKM. But we now know, contrary to those views, the children in a video recording, they've communicated their wish to be with their mother. And I think what's interesting here is the way the Mufti was speaking on behalf of the children. Now we have this video. So in a conflict situation, who should we listen to? Who should the courts listen to? And who can speak on behalf of the children?
Well, I would of course propagate that the court should listen to the children, and of course, being children, they have right to participate or to voice their view in relation in any issues relating to children. Yeah, so in particular, in cases of custody, and of course, in our law, in law reform, marriage and divorce itself, we already is provided that the court should consider wishes of the parents and wishes of the children. And therefore, I think in deciding custody battle between parents, I think children should be called in, and the judge should interview children and listen to what they wish to say. And in this particular case, I think it was a bit too late, because the husband has gone off and took the children away, and the mother had to fight her own battle. She went to court and asked for custody, which she was granted. And there is no way to get hold of the children to listen to their view. But had this case if it's going to be defended by the other parties, then the court should actually call the children and have a private interview with them and see what they say, who they wishes to live with.
There are two dimensions. One that's been telegraphed very successfully or prominently by the media, which is to do with the conversion of the children. But there's another dimension less talked about, which has to do with the fact that the father was abusive, that the mother, because of injuries that she had sustained or the threats to her welfare, you know, had to seek protection. And so we have a situation of domestic abuse that underscores the story of conversion. Everybody's focused on the conversion. What happens in an abusive situation where the father now, through the religious institutions, claims the right over the children, when in fact he's a perpetrator of violence?
Yeah, I think we must understand that the law itself, and of course now unilateral conversion is prohibited, because under our Article 204 of the Constitution, it's clearly stated that if you want to convert the children to any religion, you must get the consent of both parents, yeah, mother and father. And secondly, I think this is what is so controversial, to be so sensitive, when you actually you are trying to use a blanket or trying to overshadow the real issue. To me, custody issue is actually rights of children to have to be with their parents. Yeah? Children have that right under CRC to live in a family atmosphere, to live with their parents. And should there be a custody battle between parents, then the court must consider. Of course, under our statute, it will say welfare of the children must be paramount consideration. But if you look at CRC, best interests of children must be a priority, and it overrides over any other rights of a child, and it must be given very much, you know, due consideration by the court. And in this case, the child, the parent, the father, being what we were informed was imprisoned because of his criminal activities, and therefore the mother has actually have full rights on the children, because children must be able to live, has a right to live with one of the parents in terms of if there is a divorce. But otherwise, they both have a right to both parents. Yeah,
right.
Even in the case where the father is in prison, I think the children have a right, the father have a right of contact, should be able to visit the father as well.
Okay, so just to clarify, the CRC we're referring to is the Convention on the Rights of the Child, correct? Okay, I do want to focus a little bit on that, because what was quite disconcerting to me, Dr. Azia, was the system in which the mother could not initially locate where her children were. The children take, she, as you pointed out, she was granted sole custody of her children, but her children were taken away from her, put under religious authorities, under a welfare home or asrama, and she was then not allowed to visit or separated from her children. How does that happen? How typical is that in the welfare system, where a parent who may have sole custody of a child is separated from their children?
To me, it shouldn't have happened. Yeah, shouldn't have happened in the first place. Had the father did not, kidnap or take away the children just like that when the mother was recuperating from her domestic violence injuries, it shouldn't have happened that way. And also, I think JKM and also religious authorities should actually, before doing anything, must make sure that they investigate the matter thoroughly before actually granting custody. I mean, if you look at the Child Act, there are powers of the JKM officers and also protectors actually to look into, to keep or to even look after these children, keep them in a safe place. In particular, if there is a domestic violence, but if they did not know the facts. So I think what they should have done was to make further inquiries. Where does this student come from? Why are they here? Blah, blah, blah. And usually, I mean, we do know that if either parents or both parents were detained, were imprisoned, the children usually are under the care of JKM or the welfare officers, and they are put in, if there is no other families, they will be staying in children's homes. But even then, in cases where there are families, they will be given to families, close family, while waiting for the parents to be released. So to me, it shouldn't have happened, but it has already happened. And she didn't know her whereabouts. I mean, I believe she had made a police report, and they should be busy finding the children. Yeah. But I mean, I have to say this. I am sad that, you know, when the police report is being made, the children were missing. What I usually know is that police would say, are you still married? And if the husband has taken away the child, then, oh, it's okay, he's with his father. I mean, that's not okay. To me, you must look. If the case is not been settled yet by the court, then status quo must remain. The children should be with someone, and then they should go to court and fight for custody of these children.
Dr. Azia, is there a bias, one, against women in these systems and institutions? Is there a bias against women? And is there a bias against non-Muslim women? Because the children had been converted, was there prejudice among those in the welfare department that said, we don't want to return these children, now converted, to their non-Muslim mother? Does that prejudice exist within our institutions?
Well, I can't say that because I wouldn't know what are the circumstances in which JKM was informed. But to me, there should not be any prejudice. We are talking about the children. It is the children's right, and we are not talking about even the parents. You know, in this case, these are children of somebody. They must make the inquiries, and if they are, I mean, if you look at the Child Act, it was when the amendment was done in 2016. It is based on family-based care. So you are not even wanting these children to live with in children's homes, but they must go back to families. So therefore, I do not know whether there would be biasness or kind of attitude in terms of the JKM itself. But to me, what they should have done in the first place is that if there is a conflict between parents, they must find out what the conflict is and look at whether there have been any other court order. And by right, before even taking those children into custody, they should go to the court for children, because that's where they cannot keep children in welfare homes unless there is an order from the court. So right. Yeah, that is something, I mean, to me, if you want to call that biasness, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that directly, but they must do that first. If the religious authority actually hand them over these children, then they should go to the court for children and see whether the court will actually grant them the order to.
Okay, so what I'm hearing from you is that there were gaps in the way this case was handled. There were discrepancies in the way the case was handled. And my question is, how do we ensure that, you know, in situations like this, the best interest of the child is prioritized? What I understand you've said is that at any point in time, the child should be, you know, the utmost effort should be put forth for the child to be reunited with family. Is that accurate? How would we correct some of the missteps that have happened along the way, Dr. Azia?
To me, the law is very clear. Yeah, be it in the family law enactments or in the law reform marriage and divorce, there are wishes of children, and children should be with their family members. And of course, the Child Act is there to give you guidance. And whereas children that come from violence home, children that have been abused, even then, the best interest of the child is to be with families. So to me, the law is clear, but implementation wise, we need a lot of maybe regulation bylaws to give a specific ways in which these authorities will know how to act in cases where there is conflict between parents and issue of conversion. That is one of it. And to me, it is important to see that the children here must be heard, must listen to them and see what they think of what is going on. And then only the court could make their decision. Please, 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 I hope court will always call children in, ask them their opinion and who they would like to live with. And even in issue of religion, personally, I think they should be asked whether they want to stay on or not, and so on and so forth. And even parents have a right to guide them, but children also have a right to say what they really want here.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Professor Dato' Dr. Nurazia Awal, Children's Rights Commissioner for Suhakam. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching and good night.